This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
In the untouched regions of the forest, the kōkako runs through the treetops feeding on leaves, flowers and fruit. The South Island kōkako, with its distinctive orange wattles at the base of the bill, hasn't been sighted in many years and may be extinct. A situation the blue-wattled bird of the North Island may find itself in unless its habitat is preserved. Its delightful call includes a variety of rich organ and bell-like notes.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have with us Professor Timothy Welch, who lectures at the University of Auckland on architecture and planning and is part of the Faculty of Engineering and Design. And has been active in working on transport and other infrastructure hopes for New Zealand. Good morning, Timothy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yes, good morning to us and good evening to you.
That's
Timothy,
right.
Vince, I believe you're on sabbatical in Washington, D.C.
Not a sabbatical yet. No, I'm just doing a little bit of research before I head back to New Zealand soon.
Interesting times to be in Washington, I imagine.
It certainly is, whether you're talking about infrastructure or politics. It's all a revolving door here. It's changing every day.
Well, what got you interested in first in architecture, then in particularly infrastructure and engineering?
Yeah, so I'm coming from it from an urban planning point of view. So I originally actually studied law, and I studied international trade law, which is a pretty dry subject. So when classes came up on land use planning, it seemed relatively more exciting and interesting and just kind of something that stuck with me. So I decided to continue on with a master's and PhD and went on to teach urban planning. It was a concept like many people come to urban planning. They didn't even know it was a thing that exists, but it's something that works all the time in the background. It's how our cities are arranged and how our infrastructure is planned. And it's something we interact with on a daily basis. And we really couldn't live the lives we live today without it. But it's not something that most of us think about on a regular basis. So it's just something that I kind of fell into, like most people, and it's stuck with me ever since.
Could you explain what's the difference between physical and social infrastructure, and what is infrastructure all about?
Sure. And it's a great question. It's actually the very first thing on the very first lecture I teach in urban infrastructure or sustainable infrastructure. What in the world is infrastructure? It's a pretty broad term, but the distinction between physical and social is really important. So the physical infrastructure is all the hard stuff, and I mean like physically hard. So the built systems we have, it's the roads and the bridges, it's water pipes and power grids and railroads and ports. So all the stuff you see on a daily basis or that's buried beneath you. And it's, you know, it's all that stuff that we can touch, or what I like to call kind of the bones of the city, without which the city just wouldn't be able to stand on its own. And it's often the most expensive in terms of paying for it up front, component of our cities or our towns or even our rural villages. It's often long lasting. It can vary, but typically when we talk about physical infrastructure, we're talking 50 to 100 plus years. And it often, like I said, requires that major capital investment. And it's not often the most exciting politically thing to talk about, which is often why we have big bills for infrastructure that go unpaid year after year, which I'm sure you'll ask about later on, but then we get to social infrastructure. When we do urban planning, when we talk about even architecture or civil engineering, we think often about social infrastructure. Urban planners think more about it, I believe, but it's in the background in other disciplines mm-hmm. as well. But it's all kind of soft systems. It's what enables our communities to work. So we're talking about schools and libraries and community centers and hospitals and parks. It's where we see social connections happening, or what you might call kind of the heart of our community.
So a hospital is a part of the physical infrastructure, but it's also part of a larger social infrastructure called Health New Zealand, or
that's right. System. Yeah, a lot of our infrastructure kind of goes on both sides. It's not mutually exclusive. So some of our physical infrastructure is also our most important social infrastructure. And that's what makes it so expensive in a way, because it's kind of following, filling two roles in terms of how we develop it and pay for it.
What is the place of government debt in dealing with our decaying infrastructure? If I own a home, which actually I'm fortunate enough to do, and my roof was repaired a couple of times, and I was told it really needed to be replaced, and the whole house would suffer if I didn't replace that roof. Now, I was very fortunate. I just had enough money to replace it without borrowing. But if I had a need to go to the bank and borrow, I would have gone to the bank and borrowed the money. Should I listen to the builder who said, replace your roof or regret it? Or listen to the accountant who said, never go into debt?
Yeah, from an urban planning point of view, and often from a fiscal city management point of view, you listen to the builder. You always listen to the builder. And listen to the accountant a little bit, but make sure that they are the second vote in the room. You know, like your house, our physical infrastructure, even our social infrastructure, is the most valuable asset a country has. And if you let it collapse, just to avoid debt, it's basically, it's financial destruction in a way. And that may sound like hyperbole, but we have seen examples across the globe of cities that have ignored infrastructure to save on debt. Yeah. And at the end, they have to load up on debt to pay for that infrastructure they didn't pay for before. And our deficit is somewhere near or greater than really $100 billion. That's a deficit. That's just what we would have to pay today to kind of catch our infrastructure spending up to what it needs to be now, not including the next 30 years of spending to modernize and expand it. And if we look at government interest rates, if you have a good bond rating, you're talking 3-4%, which is much, much lower than kind of the compound cost of deferred maintenance, which could easily double that, 7-10%. Annually. So even if you look at something simple like Wellington's water pipes, right, fixing that cost, fixing that now would be in the billions. But if we wait a year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road, we're talking, multiple factors of billions of dollars to do that, as well as all the economic damage it causes by slowdowns from a lack of good water supply, of good sewage management, et cetera, et cetera. So, for every dollar we typically spend on infrastructure, we expect $2-4 in economic return from that. So it's really significant in those investments.
Why don't politicians accept that and make it public? And why doesn't the public know this?
I think it goes back to what I kind of said earlier. For lack of a better term, it's just not something kind of sexy to talk about, right? If you're on the campaign trail, if you're doing a news conference saying, we're going to repair this bridge and make sure it lasts for another 30 years, and we're going to upgrade our wastewater handling system, and we're going to spend X billion of dollars doing it, that's not getting you news headlines. That's not getting you kind of the attention you need to be reelected or to bring home the dollars to your constituents. So it gets ignored. It's kind of, like saying, I guess we don't do much of this anymore, but we, balancing your checkbook, that's not a really exciting task to do, but it's something that's really important to do in order to keep up financially. But it's just not something that gets those headlines.
Is one of the problems is that infrastructure really lasts a long time, so it's easy to ignore it until you've got problems. I mean, You can ignore your wastewater or your water system until it starts flooding through the streets. Then you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's true. And oftentimes, when we start to see the trouble with infrastructure, it can be fleeting. So take Auckland a couple years ago now. It's hard to believe it's that far past now, but if we look at the Auckland Day floods, our wastewater, our drainage system failed miserably. It's because it's so out of date. It can't keep up with the way our climate is changing, the way development has occurred across the city. But it was also fleeting. Those floods went away, the sun came out, and it wasn't something we thought about again for a while. So it's easy to kind of turn away from it and think of other things that seem more exciting.
Isn't this a problem both with our politicians and our media? I mean, don't we have a responsibility to look after those things and make ourselves aware? Why should somebody be elected to office and get away with just ignoring it until we get a crisis?
Well, because the people we put in office aren't always the people that are well-versed in how to fiscally manage a city, how to properly invest in infrastructure. They have people advising them, but they're not necessarily taking that advice. I think what really this kind of cues up is a really important conversation that needs to happen nationally, and has happened in other places as well, is how do you start to remove the politics from infrastructure? And as you were saying before, infrastructure is so long lasting, and even the buildup to funding that infrastructure takes so long, it spans multiple political cycles. And so it's so apt to just fall down or not make it through the next election. We have to have a way to bring it outside of that cycle.
You don't have to be a genius to figure this out. I've never been to university yet. You know, I can figure it out.
Yeah, no, certainly. You know, and if you were to run for office, I'd vote for you, but
not me.
The fact is, I think, I can't imagine that our politicians don't understand this is an issue. I think that's pretty clear. They know the reports come out every year. We have an entire, agency, Infrastructure New Zealand, that calculates these deficits every year and how much we should be spending, how much we're not spending. But getting that through to kind of a very political process and saying you should be prioritizing this over, whatever else is grabbing the headlines is a really difficult sell. So it's not that they don't understand it. It's that it's hard to get their attention.
I wonder if they want to understand or want people. I mean, one advantage from the politician's point of view, not having a public department of public works, things like this, there's nobody to bring it to their attention except your accountants in Treasury who are solidly opposed to debt for any reason.
Yeah. I mean, certainly if we had something like a public works department, which, again, many other places do.
We did have it.
If we were to revive it, revive it as well, that would certainly potentially depoliticize some of that infrastructure decision-making process. But, you know, even at a larger scale, at a more kind of pedantic scale, it would offer us an opportunity to kind of coordinate across regions. And we're not a big country, but we are spatially diverse. And that means there are a lot of needs and a lot of things that don't get coordinated. There's a lot of government levels that either do have money or don't have money, don't have political power. But we have kind of this lack of ability to coordinate. We need a central agency that has the funding to kind of build technical capacity. It's really not sustainable for us to rely on trying to bring in outside technical capacity every time we want to build a complex infrastructure project. We need a way to retain institutional knowledge, which, we lose that brain drain we always talk about.
When you contract out, knowledge. You lose that, don't you? Yeah.
Exactly. We just never gain it. So we bring in people that come in and do the work and then leave again. At the same time, we're losing a lot of that, those educated people that have those skills to other countries that, are building this infrastructure and financing it. So we're losing it kind of at both ends there. And it makes it really difficult mm-hmm. then in the future to kind of build up that infrastructure and maintain it.
I was looking at education a while back, and I noticed that Finland has the finest education system in the world. It's rated that way anyway. And the politicians, they have an education department that makes the decisions. And it's, every decision is not a political decision in Finland when it comes to education. Maybe some things should not be something you make a decision about every 3 years. Maybe some things should have a longer-term administration, a longer-term way of doing things and looking at them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think the countries that have, whether you're talking about education or healthcare, or you're talking about infrastructure again, the countries that have found ways to embed in, outside of the political process, the power to make these decisions and the planning process and the funding for long-term thinking are the ones that are most successful now, and are, they're now borrowing less for that infrastructure because they're less far behind than the other countries that have kind of lagged and made it a political issue.
Well, that's one of the things that I think I worry about is that we have a philosophy in a major political philosophy in New Zealand that government's bad, taxes are bad, government's bad. And so things don't happen until you have a crisis. And then you may just deal with it by bringing in an overseas contractor, leaving it to the market.
Yeah, I mean, that goes again, kind of burying your hand in the sand when it comes to thinking about infrastructure. And it goes along with the idea that, if we don't talk about it, if we don't think about it, maybe it won't be a problem. But as I was saying before, it only gets worse the more you ignore it and if you don't pay for it. Borrowing money is not a dangerous thing. It's a thing that's happened for a long time. Borrowing too much, of course, is a problem on the other side. But there is kind of a happy medium where you can use more of that money to better people's lives now.
To me, there's a different kind of borrowing. If you can, if I borrow from my food bill, my everyday expenses, that's a problem. It means I don't have enough income to live. And actually, a lot of people actually, unfortunately, don't have enough money to live. But if I borrow money to get my roof repaired, that's good financial sense. If you borrow money, especially if you're government, governments are actually more able to borrow money at a more reasonable interest rates than the private individual or even the corporate. So if you borrow money to build something you actually need and it's built right, it's a huge benefit, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. Like I said, it comes down to building infrastructure is that $2 to $4 return for every dollar spent. And you're definitely not paying 400% interest on money borrowed by the government. And so it is a wise investment in your own country, in yourself. The idea that somehow borrowing is a bad word is funny to me, because we also often have politicians that come from business and claim their business acumen as their ability to help run a country or run politics. But in business, the name of the game is leverage, right? And that's borrowing. And if you're not borrowing in business, you're not growing. You're eventually not making revenue or profit. So it's interesting that when you go from business to politics, suddenly leverage or debt goes from being kind of the key word to a dirty word. But the fact is, we don't have the money right now to invest in the infrastructure that's expensive right now, but that infrastructure is going to be multiple times more expensive if we wait farther down the road. And so it's a lot cheaper for us to borrow now and build now than to wait.
You've written a lot about transport, and we live in there are two things. We've got our Auckland in particular has got problems with traffic holdup or snarls. And it seems to have gotten worse over the years. I know that 30 years ago, they talked about rapid transit, then decided they couldn't, the new government at that time decided they couldn't afford to go forward with that. And then we also, New Zealand's small country population-wise, but geographically, we're a fairly big country. Also, we're two islands and long islands. It's a long ways from Invercargill or Dunedin to Wellington, or even, yeah. And it seems to me that airlines in the long run with climate change will be more expensive, less dependable. So what should we be doing about transport? And is it worthwhile to have a good transport system?
Yeah, certainly public transport is a really important investment. And it's, again, it's another thing that doesn't bring the headlines when you say you're going to invest in, or it might be, but it's not the headlines that are, you know, resonate and bring in votes necessarily. People just look at it and say it's really expensive. But, you know, our current policies absolutely prioritize building more roads rather than fixing our existing public transport infrastructure and our existing road infrastructure. Though every time we build a new road, what happens is it fills up in capacity within 3 to 5 years. This has been talked about since the 1940s, 1950s. It's called induced demand. So when we expand those roads, we make it cheaper technically to drive. And so people do it more. That's just anytime anything gets cheaper, people do it more. For Auckland, really what we need is probably about 40% of our mode share. So 40% of all trips that occur in Auckland ought to be by public transport if we really want to address our congestion problem. Right now it's, on a good day, 10%. We're far short of that. We need to quadruple the amount of people on public transport, but that means we need to put more money into it to make it available. And the really interesting thing, and I think the value proposition that we don't talk a lot about, is that for every dollar we put into public transport, it moves five times more people than road expansion. So we get way more back for our spending in public transport than we'll ever get back in spending on roads. But we've done things like scaled down City Rail Link's original full potential. It's great that it's coming online. We've canceled light rail. We're canceling and not investing in cycling infrastructure. Canceled bridges in the past that would have been a lot cheaper to build that would have supported public transport and walking and cycling. So we're doing all the things that we can to really hobble our traffic and then complaining and wondering why the city isn't moving. And that's really the big productivity loss when we look at why the city's not growing in terms of GDP as fast as it could be.
Well, I'm a South Islander and I've lived in South Island most of my life. So it really bothers me that I can't get on a train and get to Wellington. As you get older, buses are more difficult for you, particularly the buses in New Zealand. And flying is very, not only expensive, it's also bad for the planet.
Yeah.
So why don't they, we used to have a rail line between Invercargill and Christchurch, and then you could take a ferry to Wellington. It seems to me that it's, and I know that when they had an earthquake in Kaikoura, the first thing the freight companies asked for wasn't for more roads or get the rail back on so we can get supplies.
Yeah.
So what's the story?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, it's so much faster, I suppose, to build a road in a way. It doesn't take quite as much as building rail. So when we're looking within the political cycle about what to invest in, that's often what we think of first because it seems like it's fast and it's going to deliver results. Even though, again, it's what we're delivering is
far
less.
Rail is cheaper for upkeep than roads.
Yeah, absolutely. In the long term and in terms of operating costs, you know, when we talk about OPEX and when we talk about maintenance over the long term, it's definitely cheaper. But we have this very short term outlook on how we spend money and our return on investment is very short term when we're talking even about long term rail and other things, long-term infrastructure. But I mean, there are even short of bringing rail back between Invercargill and North Island or whatever distance you want, we have a lot of opportunities to develop good rail between many of the cities on the North Island too, and not to be North Island centric, but that's where we have the infrastructure and the population right now, and we could have some very quick wins. And there's many, many good reasons why rail would be very good. That's fast and reliable in these locations. But the fact is we still have a government that likes to build roads instead. And, you know, that's kind of to our own detriment that we keep investing in more roads and more highways. You know, with the number of people that die every year on rail is essentially zero, and it's close to zero in around the globe. But the number of people that die in car crashes in New Zealand, you know, is in the over 350 a year, globally 1.35 million. So the number of people that are dying from road crashes is a huge economic hit alone and a productivity hit. And if we incorporated some of those costs along with the idea of the emission costs from flying and all those other externalities that don't get priced into our analysis of what we should invest in, rail 100% would be much, much better investment, but we often don't include those things in our investment decisions. They're very focused towards how we can get short-term returns on cheap infrastructure.
When we do public relations for tourism or for trade in New Zealand, we talk about a great New Zealand like a green image, a green society, but actually our facts are that we're anything but green when it comes to how we deal with our transport infrastructure. Flying is one of the worst things you can do for climate change. And if you had a really good rail system, most of your transport could be on rail.
Yeah, certainly. That's absolutely right. So we are, in terms of just our transport system, our personal transport system, we are usually one or two in the world in terms of the number of vehicles owned per person in this in New Zealand. It's one of the highest in the world. And because we own a lot of cars, we drive a lot. And because we keep building more roads, we continue to drive more. And we put more freight and more of our economic eggs in the basket of roads. But that's a really dirty way to invest in your economy. And again, it comes to the fact that we don't really have great mechanisms to make people pay for or account for those emissions. For a long time, they've been essentially free and unpriced. And because of that, or dramatically underpriced, and because of that, it makes road transport and air transport seem much, much cheaper than it actually is if we accounted for the environmental cost and the long-term climate change cost that those modes are producing or will produce in the future and have already started to affect.
Is good rail transport more durable than roads?
You could certainly make that argument. I know we don't talk a lot about Russia now for good reason, but if you go to Moscow and you go down into the subway, you'll see some of the oldest subways in the world. And they're really beautifully designed and they're still running to this day. And it's essentially the same infrastructure that was built in the early 1800s. Running just as well with just some upkeep. I don't think you're going to find a road that was built in the early 1800s that's still supporting essentially the same level of service that it was, 100 some odd years ago or more, 200 years ago almost. So it's certainly more durable. It can in some cases be more vulnerable too. So we have a climate that's drastically changing. We haven't experienced quite the dramatic changes that other countries have in the Northern Hemisphere yet. In New Zealand, we've been somewhat sheltered, but things like dramatic swings in temperature, A lot of radiative heat from the sun can cause buckling and other infrastructure damage. The roads are just as susceptible, but there's a lot of vulnerability there in rail as well. So, we have to think about how we can engineer out some of that risk. But in the long term, it certainly is a much more durable form of transport than a car or a truck.
What's your attitude toward climate change? Is it a serious problem that we should be dealing with now?
Certainly. It's a problem we should have been dealing with 40 or 50 years ago or longer. So now would be a great time also. And the fact is that we're already locked into about 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. There's really no debate on this. I mean, people will say it everywhere. I'll say it again, but the science is settled on climate change. There's really very little debate about this. It's a political issue now. It's a planning issue. It's an infrastructure issue now. It's in the hands of the non-scientists really to figure out what we do from here. We're certainly almost definitely headed for a 2.5 to 3 degrees Celsius change.
Will that make a difference if we get 2.5 or 3%?
To 3 degrees. Yeah, I mean, those numbers sound small, right? Go outside. I don't notice that difference too much. But those are global averages, which what it means is massive temperature swings that we experience. It means climates that were adapted over thousands, millions of years for a specific temperature range are now well outside those temperature ranges, ecosystems that can't cope with it. We're in this weird position that we have the technology to keep ourselves cool and warm at all times. Most of the rest of the planet doesn't have that ability. We have to think about everything that we rely on that isn't air conditioned or heated year round. But the other kind of knock on is that it's not just the temperature we experience, but what it causes. So we're seeing 1 in 100 year storms that are now occurring on a 10 to 20 year basis. We're seeing an acceleration in sea level rise, which again, if you don't live near the coast, doesn't seem like a big deal to you. But when we talk about storm surge, big storms pushing water in, that goes much, much higher up and it inundates our coasts. It brings seawater into our fresh water, in which we have precious little of. We're already seeing some of these effects. We're already seeing insurance-induced retreat from coastal areas and vulnerable environments already. We're not planning and we're not moving around these locations, but we're seeing things like insurance companies making those decisions for us, which really tells us how little proactive planning we're doing and how much reactive planning is happening.
What happens when the Greenland ice cap melts and when Antarctica melts? What happens then? And what happens when 1 billion people die in Africa and parts of Europe?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a climate scientist per se, so I couldn't say exactly what's going to happen, but I mean, I don't think it takes a climate scientist to know that it's not going to be good. Whatever that causes, what does happen is, again, we have less productive growing regions across the world, so less food, higher scarcity of food, which we're already having problems with now. We have less fresh water, less hospitable climates, really just anybody can Google what happened in Europe all summer or, New Zealand's winter across the whole summer. And you can see the extreme temperatures and the number of people that have died as a result of what, in the future would seem like fairly minor swings in temperature.
What kind of ethics says that we're such a small country, it doesn't make any difference what we do. So we don't have to worry about mitigation of climate. We shouldn't really inconvenience our profit makers, whether it's in transport or farming, in order to mitigate climate change. Because we're such a small country, it doesn't matter. So we should be able to go ahead. What kind of ethics is that?
I mean, when people say that, though, the one
thing
they
mean it, they make decisions.
They do, they do. And I'd like them to kind of go to their own kids or grandkids and let them know that they've decided not to do anything about climate change because we're a small country, and see how that affects their grandkids down the road. But the reality is, I mean, even New Zealand, we have an outsized relation, I mean, I guess influence on the rest of the world. Things that happen in New Zealand get reported across the globe, and people do follow our lead. And so if we can't do it, a small country who has a small population and a lot of ability to reduce its climate footprint, if we don't do it or we can't do it, that says a lot to the rest of the world, who would have a much more difficult time reducing their emissions. So I think it's really important for us to lead the way on this, to lead by example, and also so you can look at your children and get grandchildren and say, well, we did what we could, we tried everything we could, instead just throw our hands up in the air, because that's rarely a satisfying result, you know, response to anything from anyone.
I'm going to play a song and then we'll come back.
Sounds good.
Billy Bragg. That's Billy Bragg. Right, singing about the diggers from the English Civil War. And that's when Quakers used to be radical. And a lot of English common people were radical in those days. I think we're seeing radicalism, we're seeing it in the wrong direction, because we don't have any, we don't have more positive radicals on the left.
Yeah, that could be.
Well, what do you think of, I know you're not an economist, I'm not an economist, but we, as I was saying, when I'm putting the roof on my house, I listen to my builder, not my economist or my accountant. And what, how is it, what kind of society are you going to have in the long run if your economic system is based on austerity, low wages, and low taxes for the wealthy? How does it work for New Zealand? I mean, Finland, who has similar resources to New Zealand, has forests and lakes. It doesn't have oil like Norway. It doesn't didn't have heavy industry when they started out, like Sweden or iron ore. It just had trees and lakes, yet they have one of the better welfare states in the world. They have the best education system in the world. And if you get stopped for speeding, your fine is organized according to your income. So that tells you something about Finland's attitudes. So when people say that we can't have a welfare state, we can't have a good society because we don't have the resources, they're too small. I think of Finland, and I think it's a political question, it's even more than an economic or resource question. It's a political and social question, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's there's no reason that a country really of almost any size can't better support its people. But, you know, as a country, New Zealand is probably not the worst. There are many, many worse countries that kind of focus more on individual wealth than social good. But what we often do is prioritize profits and kind of socialize future losses, right? And we're pushing the cost of running our economy onto citizens, and we're letting private companies and individuals reap the benefits of that working society. But you know, there's so much private wealth generated in New Zealand and so many other countries that is, you know, for lack of a better word, ostentatious, is unnecessary, is unspendable in a human lifespan, that could do much more good for people, that goes untaxed, that goes, into private coffers. There's absolutely no reason that more of that wealth can't be spread around the country. And yeah, like you said, it's a political issue, not a matter of economics, but it's a matter of who we vote for and what they do when they're in office.
Well, we talk about healthcare law, postcode lottery, geographic lottery. It sounds like home insurance and security and the value of our homes and land is also becoming a postcode insurance lottery.
Yeah, certainly. And like I kind of was mentioning earlier, we are in many cases being so reactive, and we lack that proactive policy making that we're now letting insurance companies make the decisions on where things will be developed, where things won't be developed, where we'll retreat from places. But the reality is, yeah, it has become, in many ways, where you live is a postal, at least an insurance lottery. And we see around New Zealand that kind of premiums can vary 400% for the identical house in a different location. And many people pick the location, you know, in real estate, the slogan is always location, location, location. It's the most important thing, but a lot of people don't have the luxury of selecting any location they want. They have the luxury of picking a location that's constrained by their own income and the reality of where they work and things like that. And so when we have people that are hit with a massive difference in just the insurance they pay alone, and then the reality of many different potential hazards that they face while in the major investment that they've made of a house, it becomes very much like a lottery. And in some places it's become completely uninsurable, and people are completely stuck, whether they just leave their house or not. And the same thing's happening with our infrastructure. But unfortunately, we are politicians and broadly, our policymakers are not thinking ahead of how we're going to fortify or retreat from our infrastructure. They're waiting for things to happen and then deciding if we rebuild and where we rebuild rather than kind of addressing that ahead of time.
You know, many people, it's not only that we can't afford, if you're not wealthy, you don't have near as many choices about where you live, whether you can own a house. But also, some people have been, for instance, in the farming community, some people have been living on that land for generations, maybe 100 years. And for other people, it's been 500 years. And their culture and spirituality is connected with where they're living. So there's a lot to consider, really. The government, well, we had an expert working group on managed retreat chaired by Sir Terence Arnold, and he had the beginning of a manual for climate change infrastructure and retreat decisions. Why did they ditch the working group's report? And was it a good decision to repeal the Natural Built Environment Act? Well, those are two different issues, but they're both worth talking about.
So, I mean, in terms of kind of the working group on managed retreat, it's a political hot potato, and nobody wants to end up with a potato and make the decisions. The big question is it's property rights versus public good, and we end up often landing on property rights. Do what you want with your land. It's yours to deal with. And so we have a political, system that's afraid to kind of speak the hard truths about what public good is and what sometimes has to be given up for the better of everybody. The cost implications of managed retreat was also terrifying to Treasury. I've proposed research before that would look ahead of time and be very proactive to try to find areas where we could retreat or at the very least fortify infrastructure well in advance of potential threats. And the amount of money that we would save doing that is astronomical, but it's not something that our government wants to fund or look into, because it's, again, it's a risky answer that they might get. You know, we have powerful property lobbies that are opposed to this idea of a managed retreat. They want to be developing anything, anywhere, at any time. And so, again, it's a political cycle where we've kind of deferred a lot of those hard decisions. So we don't have a legal framework for retreat, unfortunately. We don't have compensation mechanisms available when things need to be moved or shouldn't be built somewhere. We don't have a community-led retreat process that works, and we don't have integration with the RMA or what's going to come after the RMA. So it's just a blind game guessing at where we should develop and what happens when we've developed in a place that we should not have.
Well, if I'm a big property developer and I've got $1 billion to spend, and I hope to make $100 million out of that development, I can develop a subdivision or a shopping mall, and once I've developed it and sell it to someone, then I don't have to worry about it getting flooded. I don't have to worry about it with a landslide, because it's not my property. I've got the money in the bank, but it's not my property to worry about anymore. You know, I might only have to deal with that property from the time I built it to just maybe a year or less after it's built. So isn't that why you need longer-term planning and you need an organization that can deal with this? Isn't it almost criminal neglect not to?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly right. And it comes down to the same reason why, you know, we over-invest in air transport and road transport. It's the people that are creating what we call these externalities, these costs that the private individual or private company or developer doesn't pay for are getting kicked down to other people to suffer the consequences. They're not integrated into the balance sheet of the people who are creating these problems or these externalities or these risks. So, yeah, it's just a matter of a policy to turn that potential burden, that those costs that a developer is kicking down to someone else, into their problem or their accounting process when they buy property. If they knew that there was a risk that they couldn't develop that property or couldn't develop it to the extent that they thought they could, or sell at least the promise of that, then they probably wouldn't buy the property in the first place. But again, that comes back to our political system. They don't want to be the ones that say, they don't want to be the ones that say your property is now worth X percent less because it can't be developed to the extent that you thought it was zoned for or could have been developed. And, you know, part of that, again, comes down to the repeal of the Natural and Built Environment Act, right? So it created this huge regulatory vacuum in the middle of our climate crisis. And so we lost this integrated spatial planning aspect where we would think about the potential hazards of the land and how things should be built together to work together, whether there's enough infrastructure to support developing in this location or that. And so we kind of lost this whole idea of climate adaptation along the way, and we're not going to see anything meaningful come through the pipeline for at least another few years, if that. We've just have this kind of huge black hole where responsibility should have been taken by the government to address these issues as climate change continues to worsen.
As a way, the privatization of power model for what can happen. I mean, the power generators can actually make more money if there's a power shortage. They increase their dividends. They increase their profit when there's a power shortage. They haven't built in the structures for producing enough surplus power. So when we have a bad year, we just have power outages. And also, many people can't afford to use electric power now. So has it really benefited the consumers to privatize and bring power on the market?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky question. Again, I'm not an economist, but it comes to me to this issue of centralization of kind of a private interest, right?
So and we public only have a good few, or public
yeah, exactly.
Loss.
I mean, things right. Well, exactly. Yeah, things that should be a public good are treated as a private good, and there's a reduced number of providers of it. So when they have a monopoly or duopoly or a few more players, it means it's more expensive for everybody, and there's massive profit taking. So I think there's certainly regulatory space there. Some countries allow the private generation electricity, but it's highly regulated. I think we're pretty hands off when it comes to how we regulate that power, but we also have our eggs in essentially one basket when it comes to power generation, and we could diversify that quite a bit more.
Light-handed regulation seems to me to be depending on self-regulation. The people that are making the profit are also regulating their own industries. You've seen this with mining, for instance, in New Zealand. We would never have had the Pike River disaster if it hadn't been light-handed regulation.
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, there's a lot of self-dealing and self-interest in politics, and that can always lead to disaster. That's one of the drawbacks of neoliberalism, right? We're still coping with that to this day.
I'm glad you're coming back to New Zealand from Washington, D.C., and I'm glad we'll have people like you to help us keep aware of our the importance of infrastructure, the importance of the social good. Thanks a lot for coming on board, Timothy. It's been good to talk about the necessity of looking after our infrastructure for the public good.
Yeah, it's always important. I'm glad we can have more of those conversations and hopefully get more of them out there so everybody's aware of the issues that we face that we really need to deal with soon.
Okay, thanks a lot. We'll catch you later.
All right, bye.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.